On this first Monday of 2021, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're diving into the Wisconsin PFAS action plan published last month. PFAS are known as forever chemicals, and once they're released into our environment, they do not break down. They build up in our bloodstream and organs. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, part of the CDC, has found in studies that exposure to PFAS may heighten the risk of some forms of cancer. And their recent statement on COVID says more research is needed to understand how PFAS exposure may affect illness from COVID-19. What questions do you have about PFAS management in our state? What action do you want from lawmakers? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Darcy Foss is administrator of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Environmental Management Division. Darcy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate, for having me this morning.
Well, give us some historical context first. You've been with the DNR for decades. When did our state realize that this group of chemicals known as PFAS, that they pose a significant health risk to people and to our environment?
Well, Kate, I have to admit this kind of came in two separate waves. Early on in the early 2000s, when Minnesota realized they had a situation with 3M, we did a little bit of testing in 2008 and 2009 and really didn't find much at very high levels. But again, the science really wasn't there to detect a lot of the PFAS compounds or detect them at minute enough levels. And so we kind of took our a pause on looking at PFAS because of the science was indicating we really didn't have an issue in Wisconsin. And then again, it came up because the military in the last couple of years started sampling some of their bases due to the use of firefighting foam around the country and in Wisconsin again. And so we started to take a relook at PFAS, and our neighboring states of Michigan and Minnesota were also doing the same. So we all were kind of taking a second look at PFAS as the science got better.
At first, PFAS contamination, as you mentioned, seemed to be limited to a firefighting foam hazard, but now it seems like it's a larger problem across manufacturing. How extensive are PFAS in industry processes, especially here in Wisconsin?
That's a great question, Kate, and we're going to try and answer that with partnerships with business and local governments. I'm not sure we have a really good feeling right now on how widespread it is. We do have indications on what it could be based on a lot of the work the state of Michigan has done, but we're in the process of starting to sample businesses, wastewater. We're going to be moving ahead with some municipal well sampling, and we're starting to routinely sample our surface waters and fish, not only for mercury and PCBs, but now also for PFAS. So we're going to kind of step out from there and really see how widespread it is.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Darcy Foss, who is with the Wisconsin DNR, and she's going to be breaking down here the state's plan to address current and future PFAS contamination. Darcy, let's look at this council, this Wisconsin PFAS Action Council. How did it form?
Yeah, so when Governor Evers came into office, one of the first things he wanted to do is have the year of clean drinking water. And we realized that around the country and in the state, we were finding PFAS in our water. So in addition to the year of clean drinking water, Governor Evers passed Executive Order 40, which directed DNR to work with other state agencies, public businesses, and local governments to devise kind of a blueprint for where we should be going to figure out what's happening with PFAS in our states, its impact, and then how we could address what's going on. So that was the council. It was over 15 state agencies that met over the last year, and we put together a plan that we gave to the governor and sharing with the legislature.
Did you find that these meetings were productive, that it was important to have multiple agencies at the table?
I do think it was, Kate, and I think it not only we shared what we were doing, which we may not have known, that we were all working on different things, but also I think it raised the awareness amongst all the state agencies of the prevalence of PFAS and you know, just and how it touches what we do as state agencies, from the university to the Veterans Administration to Military Affairs to the DNR to our health group. So yes, I think it was extremely valuable to have that conversation.
And how did the council hear from the public on the issue of PFAS? How did you reach out?
Well, we did a number of things. Every meeting, obviously, was open. It was televised through the DNR and many times on Wisconsin Eye. Early on in February of last year, we had, for a couple weeks, we had an open public survey. People could online or through the mail tell us what they wanted us to do about PFAS. And again, every month or every other month, we met, and part of that end of that meeting was open forum. We had a number, a couple of advisory groups, and then at the end, when we put the plan together, we put it out for public input.
So how does this plan advise lawmakers, advise policymakers on where we go next with PFAS in trying to get our arms around these thousands of chemicals that are out there and that we can't get rid of?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate. And I think what we tried to do, again, is a blueprint for what we could be doing in the next 2 to 5 years to really move Wisconsin ahead on the issue of addressing PFAS, not only in the prevention aspect, and some of that is simply, Kate, education on the products you're using. If you had a choice and you had something you could use that was just as effective that didn't have PFAS in it, whether you're a consumer like me in the morning on what products you're using to get ready for the day, or a business, you know, can you use something that doesn't have PFAS in it? And then also what happens when it does get released into the environment? How can we address that? So, you know, we're working on both aspects of that. But this really is gives the policymakers choices as a state on here's some things we could do. Which one of these do you folks want to move ahead on? And that really was the point of this.
Darcy, how do we know? How do we know if our waterproof shoes or our nonstick pots and pans have PFAS in them?
Well, that's a great question, and it's pretty challenging to figure that out. There's a certain laws that say if something's less than a certain percent in ingredients, they really don't have to list the ingredients. There's proprietary, you know, secret corporate ingredients that we're not aware of. Some people will say that this doesn't include PFOA or PFOS, which is some of the older PFAS compounds, but there's 5,000 of these. So it doesn't really say it doesn't include any of the other PFAS compounds. So it is hard to know. I know a lot of people have called manufacturers and asked them. I know local governments have done that with their firefighting foam. And so I think it's just heightening the awareness of consumers. And one of the recommendations is that we have a labeling standard in Wisconsin that would require manufacturers to list whether or not PFAS in the ingredients in those products.
Darcy Foss, administrator of the DNR's Environmental Management Division. We're discussing a new plan on PFAS management here in Wisconsin. States like Wisconsin are proposing limits or guidelines for PFAS in drinking water. Are you worried about these forever chemicals in your tap water? What do you want to know about levels of detection in our state? What environmental policies do you want lawmakers to act on with PFAS? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing PFAS contamination in Wisconsin on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The DNR published a state action plan that aims to set standards to clean up contamination of the forever chemicals known as PFAS and prevent future pollution. PFAS are a group of chemicals, as we've been talking about, used to make coatings and products that are resistant to heat, oil, stains, grease, water, super durable. They're found in clothing, furniture, insulation, nonstick cookware. The list goes on from the CDC. Do you work in an industry that uses PFAS? What would you like regulation and standards to consider? 800-642-1234. We have DNR Administrator of the Environmental Management Division, Darcy Foss, as our guide. Darcy, looking at the situation with water, PFAS exposure typically results from contaminated drinking water. What is the state of our drinking water in the status of PFAS?
That's a good question, Kate, and we're working on that. Back in 2013, EPA required a number of municipalities in Wisconsin to test for PFAS, but the standard of testing was a little less rigorous, and so the laboratory methods have gotten a little more refined. So we may have more concerns than we are aware of. And look at Madison, Wisconsin, when 2013, when we took samples across the state for PFOA and PFOS, which are two of the substances, Madison had no detects, but as the laboratory methods have gotten more precise, they have found PFAS in every one of the wells in Madison. We've got a number of communities that have PFAS detections in some of their wells. Three in particular, have shut down some of their wells because of PFAS in those wells.
What support does the plan provide for communities like Marinette where there has been PFAS contamination?
Yeah, so Marinette is a unique community, and Peshtigo, in the fact that they have a manufacturer in that area that manufactures firefighting foam with PFAS in it and has done so for decades. And that material has been released into the sediment, surface water, the groundwater, potentially the air pathway. And so this basically would put together a recommendation that local governments, there'd be a grant program created and a loan program created to help local governments investigate and sample people's private wells. For example, the town of Peshtigo is all on private wells. And so it just really would step out and do that as far as other things like education and communication. But I think right now for Marinette, the key would be some funding to help them analyze the problem as well.
And from a policy angle here, there was a temporary rule to regulate firefighting foam that contains PFAS that went into effect last month. The legislature's Rules Committee made changes to it. Can you give us some context to the ramifications?
Yes, this is a kind of a narrow piece of legislation that simply, and the rule itself, simply addresses folks who test firefighting foam that contains PFAS, whether it's their fire suppression system in the ceiling of their commercial building, or if it's a big manufacturer like up in the Marinette area that has a large testing facility. It simply says this is how they should treat, store, and dispose of that material. So it's more of a prevention law that was to prevent future problems out there. So there were some changes made. We still feel like that's a strong piece of legislation and an emergency rule that's in place that gives strong direction to industry on how they should treat or dispose of that foam that's generated through testing.
But business groups like Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce have said that the foam rule is too stringent. How are business groups involved in the process here in understanding and drafting the PFAS action plan?
Yeah, so first, we had all kinds of open meetings, invited industry there. We did have some industry that helped participate in that. So the action plan is one thing. They were also involved actively in the rule. The industry's biggest concern was the aspect of how we thought they should be when that foam is generated from testing and you've got a bunch of literally lots of foam there, mm-hmm. how that water should be treated if that's how you were going to manage it and dispose of it. And so we basically took what the industry standard is out there, which is what's called activated carbon, which if you think of your Brita filter with your drinking water and you've got your container you put in your fridge with the little carbon cartridge in it, this would be an industrial sized series of Brita filters. And we just basically put in the rule what industry standards was that was out there right now.
We have Wisconsin DNR's Darcy Foss. As we understand the PFAS contamination in our state, how to management and the new PFAS action plan, you can join in. Do you live near a PFAS contamination site? What impact has it had? Do you work in an industry that uses PFAS? What would you like to know about regulation and standards? What questions do you have about PFAS? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Darcy, what does this plan say about the future, the cleanup, the management of PFAS contamination sites in our state?
Well, it says that we're going to have to work together, not only the state agencies. You know, we're really leaning on the University of Wisconsin and their, you know, world-class scientists to help us, but also to look to other states to work together to try to address this. And the new Biden administration is coming in and has identified PFAS as one of their top areas of concern. So I think from the once it's been discharged to the environment, it's very difficult to resolve those issues once it gets into the soil, groundwater, your drinking water. And we're really trying to work together to find solutions on how to do this cost effectively and pragmatically. So I think it's really the whole how do we restore the environment is kind of a we're going to have a big partnership here and trying to resolve how to do that best, Kate.
You mentioned other states. Have other states taken steps that Wisconsin could emulate?
I think if you look at Michigan, and we're looking at lessons learned from Michigan, we are going out and sampling a number of wastewater treatment facilities now for PFAS, and they did that across the state. And they also sampled all their municipal systems, and we are going out with a little bit of federal money that we received in one of the last defense bills, and we're going to sample 250 municipal water systems. So we are learning that way, and they're learning from us as well. We've done a little sampling on deer that they hadn't done, and Michigan had done that. My apologies. Minnesota is emulating what we're doing with deer. So we're kind of all learning from each other on that. And then we're sharing what we're doing with fish with Michigan and Minnesota, as well as foam. We've seen a lot of foam incidents on water and trying to work together on understanding, you know, the cause of the foam and how to dispose of it.
When you mentioned the 250 municipal water system samplings, what is a time frame for that?
We hope to do that early this spring. So hopefully in the next several months, we'll take a step forward. And then the PFAS action plan actually then recommends that we dedicate funds to sample all 1,700 municipal systems, but also non-municipal drinking water systems that we think could be at risk due to their location. So those would be recommendations to, you know, kind of close that loop as part of the PFAS action plan.
You mentioned education as part of this action plan. How important is education or figuring out what we as residents can do as part as trying to find a fix for PFAS contamination?
Yeah, that's a great question again. And I think we're all in a learning mode here with PFAS. You know, we all, some refer to it as emerging contaminant, but it's been around since the 1930s. And I think this is just a product of the science of manufacturing is ahead of the science of, you know, in environmental cleanups and environmental protection. So I think we really need to come to a common understanding where this is. I think there's some businesses out there and local governments, if they knew that this was in the products that they were using and there was an effective alternative that didn't contain PFAS, that they would probably move in that direction. So I think that's kind of where we need to go is, you know, what's in the products we're using. And as consumers, as I mentioned, making choices on using products with or without PFAS.
Darcy, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Kate. Appreciate it.
Darcy Foss, Administrator of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Environmental Management Division. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Wisconsin Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler is with us. We take a look at the party's priorities. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On this first Monday of the new year, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Today is the traditional in-person inauguration day of the State Senate and Assembly. Republicans hold a 61-38 majority in the Assembly. The GOP maintains its majority in the State Senate. We're taking stock of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. What transpired this election cycle? The court battles, absentee ballots, the virtual get out the vote, and what priorities look like this year and beyond. What do you want to ask the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin? It's 800-642-1234. Ben Wickler is chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Ben, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's good to be back and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. So the November election was unlike any other in history with a pandemic. The misinformation, the disinformation, the bitter divisions in our nation confronting a racist history. What did you learn up and down the ballot from what transpired this election cycle?
Well, first I'll say I hope that it remains unlike any in our history. This was just a series of nightmare conditions piled on top of each other. The second thing that blew me away is how voters mobilized, how volunteers poured themselves into it. We had record turnout all across this country and here in Wisconsin. And the level of civic participation of people understanding that their vote matters, that it will change the world, that this is the moment when they hold the future of humanity in their hands and taking action on that, it really inspired me profoundly. And I hope that, you know, while I hope that the division and the pandemic and racism and all these different things are things that we change, hopefully because of elections, I hope that that level of faith and commitment in the civic process and democratic process stays with us. So I think that's my first big reflection. I think the second thing I'll say is it mattered that we started early. At the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, we started building, under my predecessor chair, Martha Lanning, a year-round organizing program in the spring of 2017 that worked continuously for more than 3.5 years through Election Day. And every vote really, really, really mattered, as we saw. So we're going to keep on organizing year-round going forward. And I think a lesson for any state party, I hope Democratic parties in particular pay attention, is that it pays off to invest early and to work around the clock, not just in the final weeks leading up to the election.
Yeah, your strategy was to organize and fundraise as if you were behind, ignore the polls, assume your party was operating at a disadvantage. Was that a lesson you carried from 2016 when President Trump narrowly won Wisconsin?
Absolutely. In 2016, poll after poll said that Hillary Clinton was ahead in Wisconsin. On Election Day, the polling average, if you went to realclearpolitics.com, it had her up 6.5 percentage points. Russ Feingold looked like he was up over Ron Johnson in 2016 substantially. And as a result, you know, a lot of people didn't pour every last drop of gas into that fight. The national campaign didn't invest in Wisconsin. The nominee didn't visit Wisconsin. There were so many things that didn't happen because of this sense that the polls said everything was going to be okay. So this time, we would take those polls and throw them in the wastebasket. This was a ignore the polls, full steam ahead, everything you possibly can, keep adding to the program all the way to the last second.
I think pollsters are unfriending you at this moment.
It was. I will tell you, there's one thing we did look at with polls, which is whether there was substantial movement one way or the other. And the polls, you know, there were some outlier polls, but things were fairly steady for a long time. It's just a question of, you know, I think if there had been a nosedive or a sudden leap, that would have showed up and said something. But they were fairly steady. So we just had to apply this kind of mental discount. On election day, we were, I think, 6.2 percentage points up in the Real Queer Politics average this time. And so, you know, we said we need to overperform that if the polling error is the same in order to do better than we did in 2016. And the final tally, you know, we added 248,000 votes to the total from 2016, and Trump added 200,000. So this was a huge ramp up on both sides that was not reflected in the public polling. And we have a lot to do to figure out what happened with those polls. But we know one thing, which is keep on working.
Well, you know, Biden's margin of victory in Wisconsin was really slim. So was President Trump's victory in 2016. And it's really unclear moving forward what the future holds for our swing state. How do you make sense of, or how do you interpret Wisconsin voting patterns?
I think the starting place has to be that we're incredibly evenly divided as a state when it comes to which party people identify with. We are the only state in the country that has had four out of the last six presidential elections come down to less than one percentage point. I mean, the next closest state has two. It is an unbelievably close state. And we also saw that in the governor's race. In 2018, you know, Governor Evers ran a terrific campaign. I think he's doing an outstanding job as governor. And he won by 1.1 percentage points in 2018. In our neighboring states, you know, if you look at Michigan, look at the blue wall, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. In Pennsylvania, Governor Wolf won by 18 points. In Michigan, the gubernatorial candidate won by 10 percentage points. And again, we saw the same thing in 2020, that they had larger margins there. A big part of that is that the laws are much friendlier to voters. And so here it's like running an obstacle course, which our, you know, organizing and the dedication of voters helps people to traverse. But it's structurally more difficult to translate popular will into votes here. And I think part of that is reflected in this gap between polling and what you see in the reality. So you have to assume that things are going to be intense and tight. When you look at 2022, assume the governor's race could be close, even though there's a strong, you know, popular support for Governor Evers. Assume that we'll defeat Ron Johnson by one percentage point and work every day to make it happen.
Well, I want to
take anything for granted.
Yeah, I want to start there with your praise of Governor Evers, who's been dealing with a number of crises, from the pandemic to the unemployment backlog to the bitter disagreements, polarization in the legislature, and working with Republicans. How do you see Evers, you know, how do you see Evers in his job as governor?
He is a steady leader in a time of crisis. And there's such a contrast, such a refreshing contrast between what you see with Donald Trump all over the map, changing his mind wildly from one day to the next and pursuing goals that are all about himself instead of about the public, versus Tony Evers, who's wakes up every day trying to figure out what's right for Wisconsinites and then figuring out, you know, how do you make the politics work on that? Governor Evers is, I think, represents the best of our state's tradition of government that is just focused on trying to make things work. And he's up against a Republican party in the state legislature that has moved into 100% political mode. Everything is playing politics. It's all about how do you stop the governor from doing something so that he doesn't get political credit for it. You see that in lawsuits to take away his governing powers, to undermine public health authority, the refusal to actually pass any laws, even if the governor calls them into session. Over and over, they basically shirk responsibility and try to pin it on him. And he inherited a government that had been systematically underfunded So you look at something like the unemployment insurance system, it was antiquated and built to block people out, to stop people from getting benefits that they deserved. And the team in the administration has been working overtime to correct that. I'm very excited about our new head of the Department of Workforce Development, who oversaw this effort that has completely cleared out the backlog at this point by having to overhaul systems and now working with Google to do, you know, predictive modeling for who might be able to qualify. That's the kind of innovation that we need. But it's hard to turn the ship of state around. And I really give the governor a lot of credit for the tremendous effort that's been underway and will continue to be underway all the way through.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Ben Wickler, who is chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. By the way, we will have the chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, Andrew Hitt, later this month. You can join in with your questions about the party. What do you want to ask its chair? What priorities do you want to see on the docket this year? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Matt now in Nisida. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My question for the guest is there any sentiment, generally speaking, in the Democratic Party leadership regarding ranked choice voting? Would there be support within the Democratic Party leadership for ranked choice voting, instituting that in Wisconsin in either local or state elections?
Yeah, Matt, wondering if there is traction for ranked choice voting.
You know, in our state party, we actually switched to ranked choice voting for statewide party leadership positions. So the state party chair, if there were more than two candidates on the ballot, which there weren't this time, we would have had ranked choice voting. There were originally three people running for chair when I ran for chair in the spring of 2019. And so some congressional districts had ranked choice voting. If you talk to grassroots activists, there's a lot of interest. I think broadly speaking, we have a system that is under constant assault and attack right now, and trying to figure out how to make the system work better, how to make it more inclusive of voters, more reflective of voters' opinions, is really critical. I also think we don't have a dance partner in that. Republicans in the state legislature are talking about trying to pass changes to voting laws that seem like they're doubling down on the strategy that they used in the last changes to voting laws, which are to make things more voter hostile. We went to court over and over trying to expand ballot access to benefit Democrats and Republicans and independents alike. And Republicans opposed them every time, all the way up to the state Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. I think a debate and a conversation about different types of voting systems would be really welcome on a statewide basis. But we've got to have elected officials across both parties that believe in the fundamental idea of democracy instead of people trying to throw ballots out, overturn the system, lock voters out to try to prevent majority rule.
We are getting a read on the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, where it's at, priorities this year with its chair, Ben Wickler. Are you active in local party politics? What would you like to share with the state Democratic Party leader? What do you think the Democratic Party is missing when it comes to understanding its base's priorities? What is it getting right? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ben Wickler here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with the State Democratic Party Chair, Ben Wickler. He was elected chair in June of 2019. We're looking at the organizing strategy of the party and where it goes next with intense political polarization. We have an eye on that at the Capitol in Madison. You can join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mary Kay now in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Good morning. I was a poll inspector in 2008 and 2014, I'd like to know when the Democrats. What they did was they intimidate the Republicans by ostracization while you're there. They have illegals coming in to vote, and you only got to show a gas bill.
Okay, Mary Kay. So Mary Kay was a poll inspector in past elections, and Mary Kay is saying that it is a very hostile environment. Is that right, Mary Kay? and Mary Kay has dropped. Ben, what was it like for poll workers in this election cycle?
This was one of the smoothest elections anyone can remember in a way that I'm really grateful for, and so especially grateful to the many, many, many people who signed up to become poll workers and poll observers for the first time, especially young people. There was a sea change that took place between our spring election last April 7th, which you might remember the pandemic had just begun. So many poll workers were understandably concerned about exposure to the coronavirus. They dropped out, especially in larger urban centers. Milwaukee had a massive shortfall of poll workers because people were concerned that was where the pandemic was hitting the hardest. And poll workers generally traditionally have been older Wisconsinites, as they have been across the country. Then civic organizations, grassroots groups, municipalities, and both parties went into a very intense period of work to recruit poll workers as well as poll observers for precincts all across the state. And there was no shortfall. And there were young people working the polls. There were, I have a teenager friend who was working the polls here in Madison. And they watched, they oversaw a process that worked incredibly smoothly, as you could see in the recount, which changed the results almost not at all. This was a system that worked. And you could talk to local municipal authorities, local municipal clerks. You could talk to people who were observers and volunteers. It was transparent. It was successful. It was inclusive. The range of options was wide because people could vote absentee. They could vote absentee in person early, or they could vote on election day and same day register if they needed to. The system worked. And that's something that I think is a credit to our democracy, especially given the attacks. And it's part of what's made it so ghastly that people like Ron Johnson try to overturn the results afterwards and cast aspersion on the work of local heroes and champions across the state who made our democracy function in the middle of this pandemic.
Well, you mentioned the challenges to, and certainly absentee ballots in question and the court challenges there. How did you maneuver as a party through these challenges?
Our guiding principle all the way through was that every eligible voter should be able to have their vote count. The goal was, you know, if you're somebody who can't go to the DMV to get a new photo ID, but you've already demonstrated your identity and proved it in order to successfully register, you should be able to get an absentee ballot. Republicans opposed that, blocked that in court. We thought you should be able to, if you're not able to get a witness signature because you're isolated and you've made every effort, you should be able to turn in your absentee ballot and you know, have it verified that it's you by the municipal clerks. Republicans blocks that as well. That all happened in the spring election cycle. So as we went into the fall, we just focused on how do we make sure that every voter, recognizing that Republicans would not adapt the rules to include people who are shut out because of these unusual conditions, how do we make sure that people are able to vote even despite the situation? One thing that we saw in the fall that Republicans didn't oppose in the spring, and Republican-appointed justices in the U.S. Supreme Court allowed in the spring, was for absentee ballots that were sent on Election Day to be counted if they arrived within a few days. In the fall, Republicans fought that in court all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and on October, when was it? Like October 27th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled no, absentee ballots had to arrive by Election Day. There would be no provision for allowing them to come after, even though the mail system had been sabotaged by President Trump to slow down mail. And so all of our organizing was geared towards getting people to hand deliver their ballots in anticipation that the mail system might not deliver them in time. And as it turned out, almost everybody did get their ballots handed in time or mailed early enough. And so all those votes did count.
We're talking
the kind of effort people put in.
Yeah, I want to reintroduce you here, talking with the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Ben Wickler is here, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take another call now. Yan is joining us from Beaver Dam. Hi, Yan.
Good morning. I'm curious as to what the reason is that the Democratic candidate for president got over half the votes of the votes for president, but in the assembly, the Republicans won 68 out of 99 assembly seats. I'd like to hear Mr. Wickler talk about that, please.
Thank you so much for that question. And if the answer is an infuriating one, it is the intentional gerrymandering of the legislative maps. It's the drawing of legislative districts to thwart Democratic majority rule that Republicans put in place in order to lock in control for Republicans after the last census 10 years ago. And this year, a new census will come out and the legislature will redraw the maps and then face Governor Evers, who can veto gerrymandered maps if they are out of line with the principle that every voter should have an equal say. So we're going to have a redistricting fight this year. It is my deep hope and wish that Republicans in the state legislature will pay attention to the People's Maps Commission, which the governor and the lieutenant governor have created, that's been listening to folks across the state. A majority of counties across the state have now passed fair maps referenda, representing the vast majority of Wisconsinites. The public, if you look at polls, overwhelmingly wants fair maps in our state. And this year is the year we'll determine whether we'll have a democracy in the state of Wisconsin for the next decade or whether we'll keep having this gerrymandered non-majority rule system that we've suffered under for the last decade. And that, frankly, I think the public needs to be heard as we go forward.
Let's bring in Christian now in Madison with a question. Hi, Christian. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I thank you for your service, sir, on the chair of the Democratic Party. I appreciate your work. I do want to know more about how you see the current legislative agenda of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and what the Democratic Party can expect from WMC going forward. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for that question. The Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce purports to represent businesses in our state. As it turns out, they're really a kind of hardcore Republican partisan special interest organization. And their agenda over and over is to elect Republicans, no matter how out of line with public sentiment their views might be, and then use their power within the kind of Republican legislative caucuses to do things like preserving the dark store loophole that gives giant tax handouts to mega corporations. And so it winds up actually tilting the economic balance in our state away from small locally owned businesses and away from, unionized employers towards really big companies that fund the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. That's unfortunate because ideally we'd have a responsible voice of business that could be part of the conversation alongside unions and employees and the public interest as we figure out how to solve our challenges as a state.
We only have a couple seconds left here, but your term as party chair ends in June. What will you do?
I haven't made any official announcement about a potential next term as chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. I will say that I am deep in planning for our number one priority, reelecting Governor Evers, for making sure Ron Johnson's second term is his final term in the U.S. Senate, and organizing to elect Democrats and advance the progressive agenda up and down the ticket.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Kate.
Ben Wickler, chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. We'll have the chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, Andrew Hitt, later this month. Just ahead, we talk with WPR director Mike Crane about programming changes for the new year. What questions are on your mind? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.